chapter of Isaiah. And what we're going to do this morning is take a closer look at this beautiful and poetic piece of prophecy. Let me join with Gary in welcoming everyone out this morning. Particularly if you're visiting with us, we're so glad to have you with us. Glad you chose to be with us this morning as we gather together to worship our God. And let me suggest to you that the reading we just shared ultimately is an encouragement to come to Zion. And certainly what I want to do is for us to spend a little time looking at what Isaiah said and encourage you to come to Zion. That's a word we use even in our songs. Many of us have been singing songs for years that have referenced Zion. It may be not a word that's well understood by all, but hopefully, if nothing else, by the end of the day, today, we'll know exactly what we're saying when we sing that. But the idea of come to Zion is one that is borne out in the 35th chapter of the book of Isaiah here. And as we read through, verse 1 says, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, and desert shall rejoice and blossom like a crocus. And it is so helpful, I think, when we think about Old Testament prophecy, so much of it is written poetically. So when we read Old Testament prophecy, often we're also reading Hebrew poetry. And then in order to get the most out of it, there's things that we ought to understand about that. And one thing to help us, I think, better understand and appreciate Hebrew poetry is the way the Old Testament uses land. We're talking in poetry and in prophecy. It's land is used as a metaphor, and it's used as a metaphor for life with God. When we read about or hear about a desert, we're talking about a land forsaken by God. But also it's judgment on a people that have forsaken God. And we'll see a contrast between that and a people that trust God. They inhabit a land that shall someday blossom and that will someday rejoice. Even here, blossom like a flower. And that contrast is very important as we think about it. And it's evident. For instance, again, the idea of the desert, what we talked about, look in chapter 34, just across the page probably in verses 9 and 10, and see the contrast between God's judgment on worldly Edom. 34 verse 9 says, and the streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, and her soil into sulfur. Her land shall become burning pitch. Night and day it shall not be quenched. Its smokes shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. And think of what a contrast that paints to the word picture we just read in chapter 35 of Isaiah. Between the judgment on Edom and the future blessing for Israel. And we're talking about their future blessing for the children of God. Again, that we're going to see here in verse 35. Now, this is one of those places I think it's very important that we understand what the prophet's trying to do. He's trying to play on that contrast. If you're reading from the New American Standard there, your reading of verse 1 says the Arabah will rejoice and blossom. And that proper noun there I think will help us do what Isaiah wants us to do here. That's a Hebrew word. When it's translated generally, it simply means a desert plain. But it's the way the New American Standard translates it as a proper noun because that word is also used to refer to a particular or a specific desert valley that runs south from the Sea of Galilee. And that's what's pictured behind me here. And so I want you to look at that picture. Because what Isaiah wanted his original audience to do was hear that word and think of a landscape like this. That's the word picture that Isaiah is painting here. Arabah, the desert. Again, it is a soul without God or a person separated from God. But as you look at that picture, let me suggest to you that I think also it can be a portrait of a person that feels separated from God. As you think about that arid, dry landscape, sometimes perhaps when we're going through struggles in this life, sometimes when we have dealt with or are dealing with loss, or we deal with the loneliness caused by that, anytime difficulties of this life, when there are times in your life, seasons or periods of your life when you feel like God is far away, I suggest it sometimes feels like we're traveling through a desert. And that's the word picture again that Isaiah is painting here. That visual contrast is what Isaiah intended. Because of that desert, here in this prophecy, God tells his people that even though they're going through a desert now, that's not going to be the case. That they shall be glad, that they shall rejoice, and that the desert shall be transformed. That it will blossom. And verse 2 says, not only will it blossom, it will blossom abundantly. Or profusely, as one version reads. And the language is such that it's clear the idea of springing forth in new life. Land here again is personified. And we can see he's not just talking about land. He's talking about people when he introduces the emotions of joy and rejoicing and even singing. And as we think about that, again, remember Isaiah speaking for God. And when he uses the words, you shall be glad, you shall rejoice, the desert shall blossom, those are promises. Those are promises from God that though we're going through a desert, rejoicing, joy, and singing will come. It's been promised by God, and those promises ought to comfort us. Again, with more of the poetic language in the way he describes this, that desert shall be given, the glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. And the idea is that that desert, so go back to remember that picture we just looked at, Araba will be transformed from that to this. The glory of Lebanon is a reference to the mountains of Lebanon, north of Palestine there. So that original hearer of Isaiah's message, and now us by extension, think of the snow-capped peaks and the renowned cedar trees of Lebanon that were used by the ancients to build ships, to construct palaces, and even to build the temple of God. And if you get a visual contrast between the first picture you looked at and that one, that's the message Isaiah has given us. God can take us from the desert to this. This principle was known and used in Psalm 92 and verse 12. The psalmist there will write, the righteous flourish like the palm tree and grow like a cedar in Lebanon. So the glory of Lebanon would have resonated with these people. Or he said, you'll be transformed to the majesty of Carmel. And that's a reference to Mount Carmel, that verdant hill that juts out into the Mediterranean Sea when you look at maps of Palestine. And it was renowned for its trees and for its greenery. And again, the contrast is evident. And this place had a reputation for beauty as well, in as much as if you read the Song of Solomon, the young man there uses a reference to this to describe the beauty of his love. He describes his girlfriend this way. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. So if a guy is willing to use a place in reference to the beauty of the one he loves, we hope and assume that would have been well received. This place is known for a reputation for being beautiful, being verdant, those things he describes. And Isaiah gives us one more. It talks about the plain of Sharon. And this is a picture of the majestic blooms on the plain of Sharon in springtime. And that's an image that we, again, have sang but not maybe thought about. We've sing songs about Jesus, the Rose of Sharon. And if you're like me, you remember singing an old song called the Paradise Valley. There's a line in there about Sharon's perfect, sweet rose. So these are the visuals that go with those words. This is the word picture that Isaiah was painting for his readers, for those who heard his message. And again, this language is used in the Song of Solomon as well. This time the young lady describes herself. She says, I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. So certainly an image of beauty. So as we work our way through the 35th chapter here, that's the visual image that we ought to keep in mind. That contrast between Lebanon and Carmel and Sharon, these last three pictures that we've looked at, and Araba, that desert, that dry and wasteland that we began talking about. Because what we've seen here is that those places, they shall see the glory of the Lord and the majesty of our God. And I want you to notice there that the same words are used there, whether it's the glory of Lebanon or the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. But here the writer says what we're talking about really is the glory of the Lord and the majesty of our God. And to his reader there, he would say, hey, you know what a desert looks like? Now think of Lebanon. Now think of Mount Carmel. Now think of the rose of Sharon blooming in the springtime. And is that transformation apparent to you? Can you see that contrast? And his point would be, well, you ain't seen nothing yet. That transformation that's apparent, that's the work of our God. That's the glory of the Lord. That's the majesty of God. But what he does for these places, he can do for people. What he does for these landscapes, he can do and does and is still in the transformation business. He can do that transformation in the hearts and the lives of his people. Even though we go through periods of life, perhaps, where we feel like a desert, he can cause us to rejoice and be glad. And again, that promise ought to comfort us. But that promise also ought to allow us to comfort others. And that's where the prophet goes next. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. And I think his idea is, hey, what we just talked about, those words, those promises, that faith that God is going to transform ought to cause us to be strong, ought to strengthen us, ought to make us firm, and share those words with others for that same purpose. The idea that those promises ought to ease our anxiety. That when we think about our God and his promise transformation, that we ought to find strength, courage. We ought to be able to show that to others. It says, be strong, fear not. And that's what he wants for these people. And I would ask, as we think about that, fear not, what do we fear? What do we fear? Do we fear economic collapse, sickness, disease? Do we fear even our own spiritual failure? Do we fear death? Do we fear judgment? The same things these people would have feared. And the message is, be strong. Fear not. And as we think about that idea, be strong, fear not. How can we be strong? How can we not fear? And the very next line he says is, behold your God. Behold your God. There's the answer to fear. There's the answer to weakness. There's the answer to our anxieties. Behold your God. And he goes on to remind these people, and again, us by extension, our God will come with vengeance, and with the recompense of God. God will come and fix all that's broken. God will come and correct all that's wrong. God will come in judgment against the oppressors. But he also reminds us this. He will come and save you. Your God will also come in mercy and rescue those who are oppressed. And that's the comforting message of the Bible. That when God comes, it's two trips in one. When God comes, he comes in judgment of the unrighteous, but salvation of those that are his. And the message that Isaiah would have shared with these people, and again would be applicable to us, is we don't have the reality yet, but we have the promise. And those promises ought to strengthen us. Those promises ought to ease our anxiety. Your God will come and save you. Then. And so now the prophet switches. He's going to talk about, he just said your God will come and save you. And I think the then here in verse 5 makes it clear that now we're taught this is clearly a future prophecy. Then is when he's going to come to save you. And what he says here beginning in verse 5, then. When your God comes to save you, the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. And when we read verses 5 and 6, I think it becomes apparent to us, that sounds a whole lot like the ministry of Jesus, doesn't it? When, Isaiah, when is our God going to come to save us? I think he's prophesying Jesus. As you read those two verses and you think about, again, stories you know from the earthly ministry of Jesus. Jesus did these things physically. We could look at multiple stories of Jesus healing the blind. Or you might think of Mark chapter 2 where Jesus says to the paralytic, arise, take up your bed and walk. Or maybe the instance where Jesus restores the hearing and speech to a man who was deaf and mute in Mark chapter 7. And as we think how well this portrait Isaiah paints here describes and brings to mind the ministry of Jesus, let me suggest to you that that's not an accident. That really is, I think, the proof that this is what Isaiah was talking about. This language really informs the answer Jesus gives when John asks. Do you remember back in Luke chapter 7 that John, when he's in prison and he's hearing about what Jesus is doing, he sends some of his followers to Jesus and he says, you go see and find out, ask him, is he the one? Is he the one we've been waiting for? Is he the one that we should follow? Do you remember Jesus' answer? Jesus' answer in Luke chapter 7 and verse 22 is, I think, a clear reference to this passage in Isaiah. When they come and they ask Jesus those questions, here's what Jesus says, that you go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight. The lame walk. The lepers are cleansed and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up and the poor have good news preached to them. Jesus answered John's question by drawing back to the words of Isaiah. And again, we can think that Jesus went about fulfilling these things physically, but he fulfilled these things spiritually as well. As you think about this, remember the phrase, I think often you hear the term, he who has ears, let him hear. Jesus was operating on the spiritual level. Or in John 9, where Jesus kind of combines the two. You remember where he heals the man that is blind, and then he incurs the wrath or the ire of the Pharisees because of that. And there's this kind of exchange after they throw that man out and a couple Pharisees are following him along and then Jesus finds him and they're talking. Jesus there uses that instance of physically healing that man's blindness to say this, for judgment I came into this world that those who do not see may see and those who see may become blind. Jesus uses this example to say, hey, for those who think they see, I'm here for them to realize just how blinded they've been. And for those who come, by my presence, realize they haven't been seeing clearly, I'm here to make sure they now know they can see. And Jesus combined both these elements in fulfilling this. And this is what Isaiah was talking about. You may also have recognized the language referring to water there. It says, for waters break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. And already perhaps you're thinking about the things Jesus said about the living water. Turn with me, if you would, to John chapter 4. Again, just to see Jesus as the fulfillment of this promise through Isaiah. In John 4, in verse 10, and you're familiar with this story. This is Jesus talking with the woman at the well. In John 4 in verse 10, after he's asked this woman for a drink and they've had that exchange, here's what Jesus says to her. John 4 verse 10, Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. Verse 13, Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again. The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The waters break forth, Isaiah says. One version says the waters gush in the wilderness and streams in the desert. Jesus says, I'm the living water. He that drinks of me will never thirst again. And we see that same power of transformation talked about here, the impact of that water on the land, which is again the impact of Jesus on the hearts of men. The burning sand shall become a pool, the thirsty ground, springs of water, in the haunt of jackals, where they lie down, the grass shall become reeds and rushes. The water will be abundant, but again it will be transforming. The landscape goes from a desert all the way to a swamp, all the way to a wetlands that the prophet describes here when God comes to save his people. And Isaiah continues, in that time, so now, when God comes to save his people, when Jesus comes and does those things you read about in verses 5 through 7, he says, and a highway shall be there, and it will be called the Way of Holiness. And we all know Jesus said of himself, I am the way, the truth, and the life. This is the way that Isaiah prophesied here. It's the way of holiness. It's the idea of it belonging to those who walk on the way. Isaiah reinforces that by saying the unclean shall not pass over it. It will only belong to those who have been redeemed. I think it's the idea of its limited access he's talking about. It's kind of like the HOV lane on the interstate, right? I mean, everybody's going the same direction, but not everybody's going to be in the fast lane. But Isaiah's promise is that when God comes to visit his people, that he'll prepare this way of holiness. That it'll belong to those who walk in the way. Next phrase there says, even if they are fools, they shall not go astray. And I really think this is a place where ESV writers put a footnote in, and they should have just gone with the footnote. I think the translation here really messes this up. The way that ESV reads it here would give you the idea that some of the people walking on the way, even if they are fools. I just don't think that fits with the context here. The footnote for the ESV, if you're reading it, it says, if they are fools, they shall not wander in it. Well, let me suggest to you, I think that's the better translation. We're talking about a way of holiness. A fool, one who despises wisdom, one who despises instruction. A fool, one who says in his heart there is no God. There's no place for them on this way of holiness. So I think the ESV footnote or the way it's translated, the New American Standard or even the CSB capture this. The idea is that when that way of holiness is established, there won't be any fools on it. Fools will not wander on it. It won't be something that you will accidentally end up on. And not only will there not be fools, Isaiah tells the people here in verse 9, no lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come upon it. They shall not be found there. The idea, as you think about this way, that there won't be any left that on that way that prey on the redeemed. That way will be free of tempters and enticers and spiritual wolves and threats to God's people. The promise for this highway, this way of holiness, is, but the redeemed shall be there. Those that have been transformed. It'll be for them, for just the redeemed to walk therein. And this little chapter climaxes here in verse 10, where that way of holiness is leading. It says, and the ransom of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads, and they shall obtain gladness and joy. And sorrow and sighing shall flee away. And again, back to the idea of Zion. The origin of that word and its use among God's people was, if you looked it up in a dictionary, it was the name of a Canaanite fortress on a hill that David captured, and that became Jerusalem. So that oldest and most ancient part of the city of Jerusalem, known as the City of David, was sometimes referred to as Zion. Later, was used in reference to the Temple Mount, where the house of God was located there. And always then, when the Jews used the word figuratively, it talked about the idea of a dwelling place with God. And so the idea of Zion really combines all those. The idea is once that Zion is the spiritual thing that corresponds to physical Jerusalem. There's a real sense in which David McAllister has this in his commentary that Zion is the spiritual substance to which earthly Jerusalem was simply the shadow. So we say, come to Zion. We're saying, come to the dwelling place of God. Come to where God dwells. And this way of holiness that Isaiah prophesies about here, it says, will lead the ransomed of the Lord to Zion. And being ransomed is what we've already remembered this morning. The price that God paid for us to ransom us. And when Isaiah uses the term ransomed here in verse 10, it harkens back to what he's already said. The ransom here is equivalent to those who've been redeemed and are walking in the way. And what he says is those shall come to Zion. And when they come to Zion, it'll be with rejoicing, with singing, with shouting. And when they come to Zion, it'll be with a hope of everlasting joy. Joy and gladness will overtake them. And that serves as a reminder for us that sorrow in this life is temporary. Difficult things in this life are temporary. Even if they last the rest of this life, they're only temporary. And there's a hope of coming to Zion where sorrow and suffering and pain and sighing will be no more. And that's the message of Isaiah in this prophecy. That though it may feel at times like we're walking along in a desert, the redeemed shall return. The ransom shall come to Zion. And they shall rejoice eternally. But the message from Isaiah 35 for us this morning is the redeemed, the ransom. They shall rejoice eternally. And they are us. They are us. And I want you to see how the New Testament writer in Hebrews used this same language. Hebrews 12, verse 22. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. See, the Hebrew writer says, you have come. It's no longer you shall come. You have come. And the idea of myriads of angels, 10,000s upon 10,000s of angelic beings waiting for us to welcome us, to greet us there, and to greet us and welcome us to a celebration, a gathering of citizens is what that word means. Citizens of heaven. That each one of us will enjoy the status of the firstborn. It's the firstborn ones. It's in plural here. The idea there is that we all of us stand to share that same honor, that same status, that same inheritance as a firstborn son would expect in ancient times. That all of us, that is, that are enrolled as citizens of heaven. He calls it a joyful assembly. As we look forward to that ultimate and final joyful assembly. Don't you want to be part of that? Don't you want to be part of that heavenly joyful assembly? And the point of the prophecy that Isaiah made here and the point of the observation that the Hebrew writer makes here is that through Jesus Christ, we absolutely can be. Through Jesus Christ, we are and can be. But it's finally culminated. Here's what I want you to think about. Even if right now your life feels like this. And I think we all go through times and periods and seasons in life when it feels like this. Maybe you're in a desert right now. Maybe you feel like your life is a mess. Maybe it does feel like you're thirsty, wandering. The message from Isaiah is that remind us that our God has the power to transform. And the message for us from Isaiah is that He has promised to transform. And a message of hope for all of us to strengthen us when we're weak and to calm our anxieties is that we serve a God that can transform this into this and into this and into this. That was the message Isaiah had for those people. And that's the message for us as well. He can. He is. And He will. For those who will walk in the way of holiness, for those who will come to Zion. So the plea this morning is the same as it would have been for Isaiah to those people. Come to Zion. Come to where the Lord dwells. What about you this morning? Are you a citizen of the heavenly kingdom? If you're not, you can be. Do you want some of that transforming power? You can have that through Jesus Christ. If you believe that He is the Son of God, you would confess that, repent of the sin in your life, and be baptized for the remission of that sin. And start walking in that way. That way that He ushered in, that way of holiness. If you're a Christian, perhaps even thinking about some things today has been helpful. Even as Christians, sometimes we take a turn in a desert. Sometimes through decisions we make, sometimes through circumstances that are thrust upon us by life, sometimes through decisions others make that we had no control over, but we just have to deal with the impact of. But don't lose sight of the fact, even if your life feels like a desert right now, come to Zion. Come to Zion. If we can help you in any way, let us know now by coming forward while we stand, while we sing.